Hi everyone. So I'm doing a three-year project at CSIRO, and my work's feeding into the Pilbara Marine Conservation Partnership, looking at resilience and recovery of coral reefs. This is one of the first stage of my project, and it's really looking at the mechanisms that affect density-dependent coral recruitment and how they relate to coral reef recovery. So this is a kind of pristine looking coral reef, has about approximately 80% coral cover, dominated by different forms of Acropora, as well as a few other reef species, parietes, postlobres, things like that. However, we know that coral reefs are prone to disturbances, and those of course in northwest Western Australia are no exception, as has been explained to us by other people already. So in the last few years we've had multiple bleaching events, multiple cyclone events, pest outbreaks, as well as a lot of dredging related sedimentation. So once a coral reef gets into a coral depauperate state, well, how does it get back into coral dominated state? And of course that's driven through coral recruitment. So recruitment is the recolonization of new individuals to an area of reef. So recruitment begins generally at spawning time, and the larvae then drift throughout the water column from meters to hundreds of kilometers. They then move from the plankton back onto the reef, and then they form the foundation of coral reefs. Now this can be broken into different stages. So while a lot of the models we use overall assessments of survival and competency, we actually need empirical observations to inform that overall picture. So here I've broken down recruitment into various bottlenecks. So you can think of each bottleneck, it's like a filter. You have so many individuals, how many are going to pass through that filter? Now one of the first major stages is larval survival and dispersal. And as I said, that's when the larvae drift throughout the water column. And during this stage, they are mobile, they can swim. And they don't have the sensory system of fish, but they actually do have chemosensory mechanisms, as well as responding to sound and light. The next major stage is larval settlement. So that's when the corals then go from the being pelagic individuals onto the benthos. It's a major change in the life history of the coral. It's where they attach to the reef and go through metamorphosis. So they've gone from being mobile to sedentary. And this in itself is quite complex, and corals respond to many physical and chemical cues, as well as light and other things during this time. The third bottleneck is recruit survival and growth. So that's basically the time from when a coral is a settler and single individual polyp until what we would classify as a recruit. So this is a huge bottleneck, and in the first year following settlement, it's between about 0.5% and 1% of individuals actually get to that recruit stage. So we know that there's all of these different bottlenecks from various previous studies, but what we need to know is, well, how many individuals do you need to get past any of a given bottleneck? First of all, we know that each of these bottlenecks is influenced by different ecological interactions, from predators and competition, as well as diseases. So how many individuals are enough? Well, then we can look at this internal regulator, which is density-dependent regulation. So density dependency, in general, it describes a proportional success or per capita success at any given stage. So you can think about it as a total population or part of a life history stage, which is what I'm going to do. And there's three major responses with density-dependent regulation. So the first one is a negative response. So as the density of individuals increases, the per capita success actually decreases. So that's called density dependency. The second response is a density-independent response. So no matter how many individuals we have in this population, it actually doesn't matter to their per capita success. And of course, the third response is the opposite of the negative response, and that's a positive response. So the more individuals that I have, the higher my proportional success. But for coral populations, the state of knowledge is actually really depauperate, surprisingly. And when we look into recruitment, it's very, very depauperate. So there's only a handful of studies that have looked at any of these life history stages and how density dependency affects success during recruitment. And so if we just focus in on post-settlement survival, we look at the relationship between settler abundance and recruit abundance, we see that there's two studies and they both have very contrasting responses. One was done in Coral Bay, and it's a positive response between the amount of settlers and the amount of coral recruits. And the second one was conducted in Palau. And as what you see here is that if we once we move into this higher density, we actually have a negative response. But why is this occurring? And that brings me to the aim of my study, and that is to understand what are the density-dependent thresholds determining recruitment success and reef recovery. So we broke this down into a mechanistic basis, basically to understand the influence of intrinsic and extrinsic interactions on success. We use those three life history stages, looking at larval survival, sediment, and post-sediment survival. And for all of the experiments, we use the Cropper millipora. You know, it's a great model organism. Everyone uses it, so let's keep doing it. Just a bit about the methods. Firstly, we conducted two lab experiments. This is only to look at internal processes, internal regulation. The first looked at larval survival with densities of individuals from 1 to 20 individuals per 20 mil. And that's based on a maximum found in spawning slicks of 5 individuals. So we wanted to basically go, you know, below and above that. And this was ran for about 12 days following spawning, and we sampled every 24 hours. The second experiment looked at larval settlement. This was a 24-hour experiment once the larvae had reached competency, and we used those same densities plus an upper density of 50 individuals as well per 20 mils. The third experiment was a field-based experiment. This is a bit more complicated. We use these settlement tiles that we've developed, and it kind of incorporates microhabitat complexity. It's really important for invertebrate settlement because basically they really like to get into those crevice environments where it's a refugia from predation. So we spawned the corals and then we settled them onto those tiles. We mapped where every single individual was. We then transplanted those out into the field at five sites throughout the Exmouth Gulf and on the west coast of Ningaloo as well. And then we went and then remapped them so we can quantify survivorship based on various factors. And we also photographed those so we can investigate the influence of competition as well. So if we go to the first result, which is larval survival. On the x-axis, you're looking at is larval density. On the y-axis is survival. What you see here is, firstly, larval survival was very high. So this is after the 12-day period. The average is above 90%. And secondly, you can see that larval survival is density independent. So the one previous study that looked at this actually found a negative relationship, but they were working with larval densities. It was up to the thousands, if I remember rightly, per 20 mils. And this is also really important because if you want to inform models about larval survival, well, you know, you kind of need to use it in the context of your study region. If we look at how this relates to initial and final larval densities, well, it's pretty clearly a linear relationship. So the more larvae you have, well, the more you're going to have at a later time point. Now, if you look at larval settlement, we now see a different pattern, and that's a positive relationship between larval density and proportional settlement. And that's driven by this upper density of individuals here. Now, we think this is due to gregarious settlement behaviour, which is common in invertebrates. So once you have one individual that settles, well, lots of want to settle. And that's basically due to chemical, we think it's due to chemical cues. Really importantly, what this means between larval density and settler density is that it's a non-linear relationship. So, you know, we have these kind of thresholds down here that we've really got to get over to we get actually a lot of larvae onto the reef. Talking a bit slow. So now if we look at post-settlement survival, at first when we look at settlement, we see that there's a really high density of settlers in the crevices compared to the exposed habitats. This was not surprising. However, 30 days later, A, we see massive mortality of individuals, but B, we see that there's no difference. So why is this occurring? Well, if we look at influence of aggregation on survivorship, we see that when you're aggregated, when the settlers are aggregated, there's no difference. However, when with single individuals on the exposed surface that is open to predators, we see that half the individual survived compared to those in the crevices. It doesn't explain that pattern though. Now, if we look at the post-settlement survival as it's related to density, we see this strong non-linear effect, a negative relationship. As the individuals of settlers increase, their survival decreases. We only see that in the crevice habitat, whereas in the exposed microhabitats, it was density independent. Now, on the contrary, when we look at the relationship between settler abundance and recruit abundance, we see a positive relationship. And this was only significant in the individuals on those exposed microhabitats, explaining why we see at first lots in the crevices, but then over time that evened up between the microhabitats. So in summary, there was a variety of density-dependent responses. For larvae, it was density-independent, there was no relationship. For settlers, it was a positive relationship. And then for post-settlement survival, it varied depending on the microhabitat that individuals were found in. But what does this actually mean? Well, first of all, it means that excessively low or high abundances of larvae or settlers do not contribute to coral recovery. The low seems intuitive, but you actually need to get past a certain threshold before it becomes meaningful. Now, on the high end, well, density-dependent processes come in, and so supersaturating reefs with larvae actually just doesn't make a difference. In the terms of degraded reefs and reef recovery, well, it's these lower thresholds that are the greatest risk. So they're the ones that need to be surpassed before recruitment, in true terms, can take place. In terms of, well, how does a reef recover? It's that pulses of larvae arriving from nearby reefs need to arrive in sufficient enough numbers for recruitment to be meaningful. And if active management by larval saturation was thought about as an option, well, it doesn't really seem like it's a very good option. The best thing would be to grow corals to juvenile stages and then outplant those to reefs once they've really gotten past these early bottlenecks. And in other parts of the world, that's actually what is done rather than trying to saturate reefs with larvae. And this work contributes basically to the long-term goals of projects within PMCP. Building coral recruitment models, but using empirical data to inform that. We can bring that together with a larval connectivity model, and then we can use all of the ecological data that's been quantified throughout the region in reefs in different areas of degradation or not degradation. Once we have all of these parameters, we can build population models, and then using that, you can then we can then investigate the trajectories of a degraded reef and whether it will grow or whether it will stay in this kind of state of degradation. So I would like to acknowledge the Gorgon Barrow Island Net Conservation Benefits Fund, Fraser McGregor and James McLaughlin for field support, and analytical advice from Nick Ellis, and manuscript advice from Anthony Richardson, and my co-authors for, of course, assisting in this work. Thank you very much.
So Chris, split up a bit at the end, so I'll try and catch up a bit. The proportional survival was reduced at the higher existing settler densities, right?
Yep.
What about the absolute survival?
Yeah, so...
Is it still... Can you still say that there's still more survival overall that's just proportional survival?
Yes, that's right. So there was a relationship with the absolute, so in terms of limitation, but that was only significant in the microhabitat on those exposed surfaces where the density-dependent regulation, the proportional survival, was not significant. So we have these contrasting effects, which is related to basically ecological interactions. So, what we think happened is in the crevices, we didn't find any influence of competition, which is really surprising because other studies have shown that there is. So we think that's more of a disease thing, that they were just so concentrated that once one individual got sick, that quickly passed on. But on the exposed surfaces, they weren't so packed in, and predation was more important. So on those surfaces, we did see this positive relationship between settler abundance and recruit abundances.
The other major part of this equation is the nature of the substrate. And for example, crust-based coral, even colour, right? If you put a piece of red paper in an experiment versus white paper, you'd rather settle on the coloured red paper. So I guess the question is, this is a very major variable in the equation of settlement. And of course, the nature of the substrate can change not only locally, but with changing conditions as well. So you may actually have no change in actual numbers of larvae, but a change in substrate, and that alone will change the total settlement. So I just wondered, if you do have, for example, sediment has some sort of disturbance in the environment, it could actually be changing the character of the substrate. And it's a problem, it's a serious problem when people try to ascertain these two issues. So how have you dealt with it? I know you mentioned crevice versus exposed, but that's a very crude description of the surface.
So the tiles were all preconditioned in one location and then just randomized. So the sediment aspect on the tiles was
and
not...
And all the different locations. So you did... how did you deal with the totally different locations? Did you actually condition each of their relative locations?
No, not for this study, but part of my study has been doing that.
Just the difference that the nature of the substrate relative to what the substrate is in the actual environment could be a fact that's very controllable. It's pretty elementary data.
Well, yeah, I think once you want to go to the field setting, then you need to then know those ecological parameters, right? So, what proportion of the benthos is, let's say, coralline algae? You really probably even need to get to the genus of the coralline algae. Because Titanoderma is really highly inductive, whereas a Neogonolithan, they're just not going to survive even if they settle there. So, it's just it depends what level of detail you want, and I think you need to have this mechanistic understanding at some levels, but then you need to support that with field data as well to kind of bring them together. So I think some of these fundamental principles will apply, but then if we want to look at, if I have 100 larvae come to this area, 10% of my benthos there is CCA, let's say half of that is then appropriate for sediment, then what's going to happen? So we can say, we'll have major aggregations of colonies, we'll have some size escape mechanisms kicking in. However, if there's, really a lot of encrusting competitors, so sponges or bryozoans or other fleshy algae, that might change the shape of these relationships. So I think, have to kind of understand certain aspects of each parts of the whole process and then bring them together. You can't do everything at once, it doesn't work.